Doubts and Desires.
"Are you awake?"
whispered Leo. Of course she was. How could she sleep with the endless kicking of her baby, the endless noise of soldiers on the move outside the window, the endless doubts, fears, hopes chasing each other around her mind like stray dogs after the butcher's cart? Savine had to slide her arm under her belly and half lift it so she could wriggle over to face him. The first light was touching the sky outside, a faint gleam in the corners of his eyes, a glow on his cheek, shifting as his jaw nervously worked.
"You should go back to Ostenholm," he said. "It's not safe here."
"We're together in this, Leo." She tried to make her voice the essence of calm, like a mother soothing her child, like a lion tamer trying to keep his beast on the stool. "We have to be together in this." She took his hand and slid it onto her belly. She wasn't sure which of them the trembling came from. "All our futures are at stake."
"By the dead, Savine!"
His voice was the essence of panic.
"Have I made a terrible mistake?"
She felt a stab of anger then. Everyone has doubts. The fate knew she did. But leaders have to crush their doubts down deep inside, where they cannot leak out and stain the entire enterprise. It was far too late for second thoughts. The dice were out of their hands and already rolling. She felt a stab of anger, but losing her temper was a luxury she could not afford.
"You've done the right thing."
She made herself meet his eye, made herself sound sure.
"You've done what you had to."
"Can I trust Isha?"
Savine would not have trusted him to carry her nightpot.
"Of course you can. He's bound to us, Leo. He has no..."
"Can I trust Stour?"
To call Stour a wild dog was unfair. Wild dogs were at least capable of loyalty.
"He respects you, and it's a little late to be..."
"Can I trust you?"
Silence. Faint cries and clatters outside as they moved up supplies by torchlight.
"How can you ask me that?"
she snarled. She wanted to slap him.
"You're the one who chose this. All I've done is everything I can to make sure it succeeds."
And promised Ulfrith to Stour, and promised the closed council to Isha, and promised the throne to herself.
"Also stuffed your head with doubts, didn't he? Damn it, I told you not to underestimate him."
Another silence. She could hear his quick breathing. She could hear her own.
"You're right," he said grudgingly. "You're always bloody right."
He even managed to make that sound like an accusation.
"I just don't even know where half my friends are, let alone my enemies. Ricker and Durand."
"Leo,
what if my mother was right? What if I'm a warrior but no general? What if..."
She wished she did not always have to be the strong one. The fates knew she could have used some comfort. But some people need to be held up, which means some people need to do the holding. She clapped a hand to his head, twisted her fingers in his hair, and dragged his face towards her.
"Stop. You're not just a warrior, or a leader, or a general. You're a hero."
Heroes are defined not by what they do, after all, or why, but by what people think they have done.
"The cause is just."
She would be a wonderful queen.
"We have strong allies beside us."
A circle of self-serving snakes.
"We are going to win."
They had fucking better.
"And the people of the Union will win with us. They need us. They need you."
It did not matter whether she believed it, only that she made him believe. She had to blow him up with hot air until he towered over the battlefield.
"I need you."
And she pulled him close and gave him the softest kiss. It had been meant just to shut him up, but it lasted longer than she had expected. When she broke away, they stared at each other in the darkness, quick breath hissing between them. She licked her lips and went back for another. Hungrier now and deeper, wriggling half on top of him. The constant ache between her legs had already sharpened to a pleasurable throbbing. It wasn't just her hands that were endlessly swollen. She slipped one leg over his and started to rub herself against it, subtly at first, then not subtly at all, humping him like an overeager puppy.
"Are you sure?" he whispered.
"We're all awake now." And she caught his head and pushed her tongue into his mouth. This was one thing she had not expected about carrying a child. She had never felt less capable of coupling, never wanted to more, even now, with everything she had at stake, especially now, maybe. He was half hard by the time she got his nightshirt up. She kept kissing him, one hand between her legs, one hand between his. Someone has to do the work, after all. When she gave birth to this bloody thing, it would be heir to the throne of the Union. That decision was made already. She would never be caught defenceless again, as she had been in Valbec. Never be scared, never be vulnerable. If Orso had to lose, and her father, and Ricca, so be it. She would be safe. She would be powerful. If the world had to lose so she could win, so be it. The dice were already rolling. She grunted as she heaved herself over onto her hands and knees, squirmed as she dragged her nightdress clumsily up over her hips. He knelt there, staring at her bare ass, nightshirt draped over his cock like a theatre curtain caught on a rogue piece of the set. Ridiculous, but there it was. She slid her elbows forward so the mattress could give some support to her over-heavy chest and pushed the side of her face into the pillow.
"Get it done, then," she hissed.
Tallow stood with his hands wedged in his armpits as the wind bent the tall grass, shivering. He never seemed to have the right clothes for the weather, exactly like her brother in that regard. The thought made Vic feel decidedly uncomfortable, and she drew her coat tight about her. A black inquisitor's coat. Not something she wore often. She spent most of her time trying to look as little like a member of the Inquisition as possible. But if you didn't wear your uniform to a battle, when would you? From up here on the bluff, the dark valley was dusted with thousands of pinprick lights, campfires, wagon lamps, sentries' torches. You could pick out the roads, the cluster of Stauffenbeck's windows, the long battle lines cutting crooked across the hills and fields in dots of fire, a gulf of darkness lying between the two sides. "Not often you get seats like this at the show everyone's talking about," muttered Vic. "Imagine how much it costs to put on."
"Think what you could buy with it,"
said Tallow, firelight glinting in the corners of his big sad eyes.
"The folk that could be fed and clothed and housed. Spend it wisely, you might avoid the fight in the first place."
"There's something wrong with the world, all right," said Vic, watching Archlector Pike step over to the closest cannon and sight down its barrel into the darkened valley. He'd positioned them with the care of an emperor's butler setting table for a state dinner. 18 darkly gleaming, tapering tubes set on heavy wooden trestles in a long row just below the brow of the hill. Leather-aproned engineers from the siege school followed His Eminence down the line, cranking, adjusting, checking instruments, pointing excitedly towards the river where water glimmered faintly in the darkness.
"This one a little to the left, I think," said Pike, then walked up to the summit of the hill to stand beside Vic, staring out at the valley. "We have been experimenting in the far country for several years now."
He watched the crews drag brush around the moors of the great iron tubes to hide them from sight, "and have found that cannons are like birthday presents, best kept as a surprise."
"I've never liked surprises," said Vic. "I suspect the enemy will feel the same."
"Your Eminence!"
Two dark figures came across the hillside. One had a torch and a mask. The other was a boy stumbling along with hands tied behind him, a practical and a prisoner.
"Caught him trying to run!"
The practical shoved the lad down on his knees in front of Pike, the wind ruffling his curly hair. Couldn't have been more than 14, looked younger. Tallow swallowed and slowly shrank back into the darkness.
"Dear, dear,"
Pike took a long breath and squatted beside the boy, torchlight glistening on the shiny burned skin on the side of his face. "Do you know who I am?" The lad nodded, mouth hanging dumbly open. He looked up at Vic and took a long sniff, then looked down at the ground between his knees. He must have known what was coming, and yet he just sat there. "Which unit are you with?"
"Lord Krant's regiment," he croaked out. "I'm a loader. I load flatbows. Well, I just crank 'em."
Once he'd started talking, he couldn't seem to stop.
"My friend Gert puts the bolts in, then hands 'em back to..."
"Shh," said Pike softly. There was silence then, and the wind stirred the grass, and Vic found she was wincing. The boy would make a good example to keep the others at their posts. There was a tree near the summit with a low bough that would be just right. If they'll hang a boy for running, who won't they hang?
"Gert stayed," whispered the boy, "but I don't want to die."
Pike turned towards those thousands of pinprick lights twinkling in the valley. Faced with something on this scale, there could be no more rational response than to run away. But sometimes we must do things that are not rational. Sometimes we must act on faith. Pike stared at the lad, and the lad stared back, the practical looming dark over both. "Sometimes, even as the world goes mad, we must crouch next to Gert and load flatbows." Another silence, then the lad's knobbly throat shifted as he swallowed.
"I'd like to do that."
"Good." Pike set his hand on the boy's shoulder. "Go back to Lord Krant's regiment, then." He nodded to the practical, and the practical cut the ropes on the boy's wrists.
"What do I tell them?"
"That you got lost, but I guided you back to the right path. Isn't that the truth?" The boy wiped tears on his sleeve.
"That's the truth."
"This time, for both our sakes, you should stay at your post." The boy jumped up like an eager puppy.
"I'll stay there if hell comes up the hill in the morning."
"I suppose it very well might," murmured Pike as he watched him scurry away. "You look surprised, Inquisitor."
"I was expecting something harsher," said Vic, "from your reputation."
"I find reputations rarely fit people all that well. What are they, after all, but costumes we put on to disguise ourselves?" The mottled skin above his hairless brows twitched as he gave her uniform a glance. "Costumes we are forced to put on. If men are to be productive, they must have something to fear. That is why we have an Inquisition. I like to tell myself that every life I have taken has saved 5 more, 50 more, perhaps. Not everyone has the stomach for that kind of arithmetic." His eyes gleamed with the practical's torch. "It is one thing I admire about you, Inquisitor Teufel. One cannot come through the camps without developing a very strong stomach." Vic said nothing as the boy vanished over the crest of the hill, a black figure against the dark sky. "I understand, cowards," said Pike softly. "I used to be one. Who among us never had a weak moment after all? It cannot all be darkness. We must have a little mercy." He leaned sideways to whisper it, "As long as no one sees." Broad sat and polished his armour. Didn't need polishing. Brand new from the armoury at Ostenholm. But it helps to have a routine. He used to do it out in Styria, the long nights before the long dawns. Kept him calm. That and the drink, anyway. And who is going to sleep now? Scattered in every direction were other fires, other little knots of sleepless men, scraping the time away as the light leaked into the sky, talking solemnly about the ground, or brashly about deeds they'd do tomorrow, or mournfully about families waiting back at home. Maybe Broad should have been thinking of his family, of May's quick look sideways when she spoke,
the lines around Liddy's eyes when she smiled. But he knew what was coming with the dawn, and he didn't want it to touch them, not even in his memory.
"That all the armour you'll wear?"
asked Bannerman, firelight shifting across that little smile he liked to wear.
"Aye," said Broad,
breastplate and steel cap, nothing clever.
"Laddermen prefer to go light."
Halder rubbed at the tattoo at the back of his hand, same as Broad's, but with just the one star. Some would say that was one too many.
"Quicker you get to the top, the better your chances."
"The best armour's quick feet and high hopes," Broad murmured.
That was what they used to say to each other while they waited for an assault, usually while getting good and drunk.
"Defence won't save you in the press at the top of those walls," said Halder. "Only attack, only fury."
Broad kept his eyes on the steel, but his heart was thudding.
"No room to think."
He remembered what happened when you got to the top of the ladder.
"No room to breathe.
The cauldron of violence. Men made animals. Men made meat.
Pressed in so close, you'll never reach a weapon at your hip, let alone swing it."
Halder was whispering it now.
"You need something you can use to kill a man who's close enough to kiss."
That's why Broad wore a stabbing dagger across his chest, more a long spike than a knife, its three edges barely even sharpened. It was the point did the work, overhand, up under a helmet or into the joints in armour, or the pommel, or the heavy knuckle guard in a pinch. He remembered the feel of a cheekbone crunching, the sticky trickle of blood down the grip. Broad winced as he made his aching fist unclench. He wondered if Judge had been right. Only happy when he was bloody.
"Well, we've got no walls to climb," said Bannerman, "so I'll take a sword, thanks all the same."
And he drew a few inches of his own blade, then slapped it back into its sheath.
"Sword's a fine thing for riding down archers. Fighting armoured men face to face, you can do better."
Halder nodded at Broad's warhammer, laid out on an oilcloth, waiting for its own turn to be polished.
"Hit a helmet hard with that, you can crack the skull inside without breaking the steel."
True enough. But Broad had got more use from the bladed pick on the back. Fine thing for hooking a man who was leaning over a parapet and dragging him off. Fine thing for hooking down a shield so you could get at the flesh behind it with a dagger. And if you could find room for a proper swing, there wasn't much you couldn't punch through with it either, if you didn't mind getting it stuck. You can't get attached to weapons in a battle any more than you can get attached to men. Sometimes you have to leave 'em in the dirt. Orso stared at himself in the mirror. He had got as far as putting his trousers on before he noticed his reflection, and now, even facing imminent destruction, he could not look away. No doubt an observer would have thought him immensely vain, but the truth was, Orso saw no fine features in a mirror, only faults and failures.
"More reinforcements!"
Hildy stood at one of the windows of the grand room the mayor had insisted Orso slept in, watching soldiers tramp past Stauffenbeck's town hall towards the front, where they would soon be fighting, where they would soon be dying. That was the theme of Orso's reign, the conversion of brave men into corpses. "Three regiments came in last night," he said, "as well as a hugely enthusiastic group of farmers from the next valley demanding to fight for their king."
"Inspiring."
"If you find stupidity inspiring." Also did, in fact, but he had ordered them back home regardless.
"Position stronger, though?" asked Hildy, hopefully.
"Stronger than it was. Lord Marshal Forrest still considers us well outnumbered."
"Battles aren't always won by the biggest numbers."
"No," said Orso, "just usually." He placed an unhappy hand on his belly and tried his best to suck it in. One cannot suck in one's hips, though. It was reaching the point where he was considering some form of corset. Savine always looked spectacular in them, after all, and exercise was out of the bloody question.
He let it all sag again with horrifying results.
"I dare say Leo Dan Brock never has to hold in his belly," he murmured. "Wouldn't have thought so. All hard and grooved like a cobbled street, I reckon."
Hildy was gazing into the corner of the room with a dreamy expression, combining the best of dancer and docker, while I combine the worst of idler and innkeeper. Also pulled his shirt on with bad grace. "Maybe you can get a job oiling the young lion's stomach once he's replaced me. A girl can dream. There's more to a man than his gut."
"No doubt. You've put some weight on under the chin as well."
Orso sighed.
"Thank you very much for that, Hildy. I'm never at risk of getting too self-satisfied with you around."
He twitched a curtain back to watch those men marching past. Probably he should have been moved by their loyalty. His father would have flapped a half-clenched fist around and trotted out some patriotic platitude, but also found himself wondering what strange combination of doubts and desires compelled each individual to subsume themselves into this metal mass, plodding towards their own destruction rather than making the eminently sensible choice to run like hell the other way. Then he found himself wondering why he was still there, and slapped impatiently at the side of his head.
"Damn it, Hildy! I think far too much to make a good general.
That, and you've no military training, talent, or experience.
Training, talent, or experience would only be encumbrances to a monarch. Such petty concerns are for the little people, my dear."
From the window, he could see the low ridge to the east of town, the spindly trees on top, a faint hint of dawn showing in the clouds behind.
"When the sun comes up, I'm going to have to bloody fight.
Shall I get your armour?"
"I think you'd better.
And tell Berniel I'm ready for breakfast."
"Diet tomorrow, eh?"
Orso patted at his stomach.
"If I'm still alive."
Stour Nightfall was having quite the sulk. Flick had built a good fire for breakfast near to the tree line, where they could get news if aught happened on the hills ahead. Flick wasn't bad at building fires, and he'd built an especially pleasing one that morning. But as Stour's mood blackened, everyone had slowly shuffled back, sidling around the trees and skulking through the bushes to get out of his eyeline, loitering at the edge of the firelight and leaving a widening empty circle about the King of the Northmen. It seemed the only man who dared stay close was Clover himself, and that was mostly because he was enjoying having his feet near the warmth. The Union was meant to be so very bloody civilized, but so far the place was a sea of mud. His boots had got soaked yesterday, and the cold had worked right into his feet. Being on campaign was far from comfortable at the best of times. He was damned if he was going to let Stour's sulking make him even less comfortable. And Clover reckoned you took more of a risk backing away from a slavering wolf than you did calmly standing your ground. So he sat there and slowly picked a leg of cold mutton down to the bone.
"I could have gone last night," snarled Stour, and he kicked a smouldering branch from the fire and sent it spinning away, showering sparks. "Why didn't we go last night?"
"Couldn't say, my king," said Clover. "Big army to manage, I reckon."
"Big army to manage," sneered the king, and he kicked out at a cookpot and sent it bouncing between the trees, where it hit a carl on the side of his knee and made him squeak with pain, though he kept smiling all the while, which was quite a feat.
If Stour had been an 8-year-old, he'd have got a slap from his mummy. Instead, he got every bastard bowing and grinning and pandering to him, even those he kicked cookpots at. That, of course, only made him rage the worse.
"We've joined up with a pack of fools," Stour said.
The rest of them had been given no choice but to follow.
"You see that fat idiot Barazin? He came in Gleeman's feast day clothes, didn't he? You see that skinny idiot Isha? Looks like a fucking wilting cock. As for the bunch of jesters they're leading..."
He gave a snort that sent snot shooting out of his nose and angrily dashed it away.
"Fucking southerners! What was I thinking?" Mostly that he was bored and he wanted to fight someone, Clover imagined, and there'd been no one big enough within arm's reach.
That cunt Ricker had the right idea. Says yes, then stays home in Ulfrith, frigging herself. Thinks she can laugh at me, does she?
Clover nibbled a few more shreds of meat from the bone.
Couldn't say.
My king?
A wincing Carl was edging up, an eyeglass offered out to Stour like he was sticking his arm in a fire.
What now?
Reckon you ought to see this.
Stour snatched the eyeglass, stomped to the tree line, and trained it on the low hill beyond that long slope of darkened wheat, its shape clear now against the brightening sky.
What the fuck?
He hissed.
They were reinforced in the night, said Jin. 2 regiments of King's Horn, maybe 3.
The sun was peeping over the valley, long shadows stretching across the fields. Through the round window of his eyeglass, quivering slightly with the trembling of his hand, Leo could see the flags, the spears, the lines of men on top of the 2 hills. The rocky bluff crawled with activity now, like a distant ant-heap. The long, low hill had at least 2x as many soldiers on it as the night before. 1 flag in particular, black with a golden sun, flew above the rest, a Lord Marshal's personal standard.
He took me for a bloody fool, breathed Leo. He played me for time, knowing he had men on the way.
He felt a sudden cold shock. Had that woman Teufel tricked them? Had she been loyal to the king all along, lied about his strength, then taken the secrets they'd merrily blabbed to her straight back to him? Had also been well aware of that as he smirked across the table and tried to drive a wedge between Leo and his allies, between Leo and his own wife?
Fuck!
He flung the eyeglass across the hillside and it bounced once and clattered from one of the wagons with a tinkle of broken glass. Shock turned to a reassuring fury that burned all the knight's doubts away. He was the young lion, dammit. He'd no business dithering when there was an enemy ahead.
What should we do?
Asked Isha, plucking at a loose thread on his embroidered cuff as he stared towards those suddenly well-held hills.
Attack! Snarled Leo. Now!
Finally!
Barazin mashed his fist into his palm.
My Gurkish legion will be on that bluff before lunchtime. You can depend on it.
I am bloody depending on it, Leo forced through his gritted teeth. Barazin gave a cavalier salute, caught hold of his saddle horn, bounced a couple of times, and then, with some subtle shoving from one of his aides, hauled himself up and turned his mount towards the west. Leo took Isha by the shoulder.
I don't care whether it's a Gurkish legion or a phalanx of Sipanese whores, he hissed into his pale face. I need men up on that bluff in force and ready to attack Stauffenbeck from the west as soon as possible. Do you understand?
Isha wiped sweat from his forehead and gave a stiff salute.
I do.
And he strode somewhat unsteadily to his horse. Leo pulled Antaup close, pointed over the orchards towards the rocky hill, one flank bright with the dawn, the other cast into shadow.
First, the open council, drive them back on the right and take that bluff.
He shoved forward with his fist from the neat battle lines of Angland and across the open fields towards Stauffenbeck.
By the time we attack Orso in the centre, they'll be in a position to outflank him.
He stabbed his finger towards the wheat fields, the gentle green hill beyond, with those new banners at its summit.
Before they shore up the centre, Stour will hit them on the left.
Antaup grinned as he flicked that loose lock of hair out of his face and it dropped straight back.
Yes, Your Grace. Let the Anglanders know.
And Leo sent Antaup charging down the hill with a slap on the back.
Greenway.
He slouched over, giving a mockery of a Union salute.
Young lion.
Tell Stour we're attacking from right across to left. He goes last.
Last?
Sneered Greenway.
It's a battle plan, not a race.
Don't reckon Stour'll like going...
Leo grabbed a fistful of Greenway's cloak and snarled the words in his face.
He doesn't have to like it. He just has to do it.
and he shoved the man away and made him slither on the dewy grass. He only just righted himself before he fell and slunk off with bad grace.
"Might not be wise to treat him with so little respect," murmured Jin.
"I had a go at being wise," snapped Leo. "It doesn't fucking suit me."
Jin laughed and thumped him on the shoulder.
"That's the spirit."
Leo looked towards the low ridge, the high bluff, the town with the crescent of diggings in front, a fierce smile on his face. He liked this plan. Simple, aggressive. It played to his strengths. He wished he'd done it last night, but last night wasn't coming back. They were ready now and had the whole day ahead of them. He felt like a new man.
"We could have beaten him last night."
He curled his fingers into a trembling fist. "But we'll crush him today instead.
Someone get my horse!"